under the current construct, they're allowed to take and to appropriate as much as they need out of the earnings reserve account.
Concern builds around the differing legislative plans for using permanent fund earnings. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, more money for repairs to the Port Mackenzie barge dock.
It's kind of a fine line between, are we far-sighted visionaries of an eventually successful port, or are we just fools pouring more money down a black hole?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska Southeast offers the Finnish College Alaska initiative, designed with flexible online learning options and customized degree programs. It's college that fits life, work, and play schedules while earning a degree. UAS is now offering a 3-credit tuition waiver for eligible applicants. Apply for the fall semester by Tuesday, August the 1st. Learn more at finnishcollege.alaska.edu. This message is sponsored by UAS.
Lawmakers have proposed drawing money from the Alaska Permanent Fund earnings to pay for state government for the first time. But as the legislature focuses on preventing a government shutdown, it's increasingly likely the draw won't be based on any one plan. And that's raising concerns with lawmakers, the fund's leader, and a bond rating firm. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Ever since a few years after the Permanent Fund was approved by voters in 1976, its earnings have been used for two purposes: to grow the fund and for Permanent Fund dividends. But with the state bringing in less than 40 cents in taxes, fees, and oil royalties for every dollar it spends, both the House and Senate have passed bills to draw from earnings to cover the gap. But they haven't agreed on a plan on how much to draw. And without a plan, they've proposed two very different amounts. The House passed a budget last Thursday that would draw nearly $5 billion from fund earnings, 40% of the current earnings account. The Senate would draw half that amount. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon says the House draw is too large.
I'll speak specifically to a $5 billion draw from Alaska's permanent fund earnings account that will devastate revenue coming into our state, as well as the security of Alaska's dividends.
There are two big reasons why the House draw is larger. One is that the House included a lot more money for PFDs after it voted to restore full dividend checks last week. House members say the state should only cut PFDs from more than $2,000 to roughly half that amount under one condition. There are other new sources of money for the state, such as higher taxes on the oil and gas industry or a broad-based tax. Anchorage Republican Gabrielle Ledoux of the House majority explains her side's position.
One thing that we were all in agreement on was that a comprehensive fiscal plan should not be composed of simply reducing the permanent fund dividend. It had to be comprehensive. That means everybody needed to be at the table, including the oil companies.
So that's one reason why they differ. The other difference is that the House included nearly $2 billion for an account appropriated for future school budgets. The legislature used to do this before the budget gap grew in the past few years. The Senate didn't include any draw for this future funding. Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Chief Executive Angela Rodell expressed concern earlier this month about a large draw from earnings without the legislature passing a plan to use it.
Part of my concern will be if that doesn't pass, sort of the unknown quality of how much money they're going to use, because under the current construct, they're allowed to take and to appropriate as much as they need out of the earnings reserve account.
Rodell notes that the legislature has handled permanent fund earnings based on rules set by state law. At least that's been true up until now.
I'm hopeful that we are able to get back to a more rules-based strategy like we've had in the past going forward.
When Governor Bill Walker included only the operating budget on his call for the second special session last week, he focused the legislature's attention on preventing a shutdown. But without the bills that would set up a plan for future permanent fund earnings draws, the legislature may now spend earnings without a plan. That has bond ratings firm Standard & Poor's concerned. S&P issued a negative watch on Tuesday, saying that it would likely downgrade the state's debt if the legislature doesn't pass a plan to balance the state's future budgets. This downgrade could make it more expensive for the state to borrow in the future. Walker says he'll add more topics for the legislature to consider, such as a plan for permanent fund earnings, after lawmakers agree on a budget. The state government will shut down on July 1st if there's no budget by then. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Hillcorp snapped up more than 100,000 acres in Cook Inlet for additional oil and gas development at a federal and state lease sale held today. The Federal Bureau of Ocean Energy Management offered over 1 million acres in the inlet for lease. The agency's last three Cook Inlet lease sales were canceled when the oil industry wasn't interested in developing there. But at this year's federal sale, Hillcorp submitted over $3 million in bids. The private Texas-based company is the inlet's predominant oil and gas producer. The company picked up more acreage at the state lease sale. In both sales, Hillcorp was the only bidder. Dave Johnson, who oversees leasing for the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, said on a call with reporters that he wasn't surprised to see Hillcorp's interest.
Hillcorp, as you know, has been very active in the upper Cook Inlet. I think this is just kind of a natural extension for Hillcorp to be looking kind of in the southern end of the inlet.
Vincent DeVito, who advises the Interior Secretary on energy policy, added that he thinks the Trump administration's industry-friendly policies also influenced the results.
We are focused on Alaska energy, and the signaling that has been coming out of this administration is also catalyzing the optimism.
Not everyone is happy about the lease sale results. In a statement, watchdog environmental group Cook Inlet Keeper said the federal lease sale marked a turning point for Cook Inlet. The group is concerned that oil and gas development will harm the region's fishing and tourism industries. Earlier this year, a gas leak from a fuel line powering one of Hillcorp's oil platforms went on for months before it could be repaired, drawing intense criticism from Cook Inlet Keeper and other environmental groups. Yesterday, the Mat-Su Borough Assembly approved the transfer of more than $500,000 from existing funds to pay for repairs to the Port McKenzie barge dock, although some expressed reservations about the port's continuing costs. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
With its vote on Tuesday, the Mat-Su Borough Assembly took money from funds dedicated to Port McKenzie and the MV Susitna to pay for repairs to the port's barge dock. The vote comes as the insurance claim for another repair of nearly $2 million to the port is under review. Borough Manager John Moosey says a payout from the insurance company for that repair is not a certainty.
It's not a sure thing that we are going to get reimbursement on this claim. We're working towards it, but I think we have an uphill battle. I'd say the reimbursement from the insurance company is in doubt.
Assemblymember Dan Mayfield, whose district includes Port McKenzie, says he supports funding the repairs to protect the port as an asset to the borough.
The port is an asset that we really have to protect. I realize we don't have a lot of leases at the port at this point in time, but it's a very, very valuable asset. It would be like this building here having one quarter of the building having a gigantic hole in it.
Assemblymember Randall Kowalki, whose district includes the Northern Valley, says he had to hold his nose to vote for more funding for repairs to the port, but also envisions a future where it makes a profit.
I think it's the jewel in the crown. I think the day will come when the Kabata Bridge is built, when the international airport for this region will be in that area. We'll have the rail complete. A lot of things are going to happen out there. We can guarantee that they don't happen if we let it wash into the inlet.
Assemblymember Jim Sykes says it would be more expensive to mothball or abandon the port than to make this repair, so he's willing to support the funding. Sykes also says he's not certain how long his support for funding the port, which is not heavily used at this time, will last. He says the borough has to balance between protecting an asset and risking throwing money away.
It's kind of a fine line between are we far-sighted visionaries of an eventually successful port, or are we just fools pouring more money down a black hole? That's a fine line.
Ultimately, moving funds to pay for repairs to Port McKenzie's barge dock passed by a vote of 6-1, with Assemblymember George McKee voting against the move. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, excitement in Naknek as the summer fishing season ramps up.
Just got the feel that there's just more people here visiting and working than there were last year.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The Army Corps of Engineers has identified a man killed on an Alaska construction project as a Chicago employee on temporary assignment. Melvin McLaurin died Monday afternoon while operating heavy equipment on the Chena River Flood Control Project outside of North Pole. McLaurin worked as an engineering equipment operator lead with the Corps' Chicago District. The agency says McLaurin was operating a roller compactor on a stability berm and preparing the site to install a relief well. The compactor rolled just before 4 p.m. Emergency responders declared McLaurin dead about a half hour later. The agency and the Occupational Safety and Health Administration are investigating. The city of Fairbanks is offering a $20,000 bonus to attract seasoned police officers after the money was approved unanimously by the city council on Monday. FPD is short 9 officers, and it's estimated to take 4 years to fill the posts with rookie recruits who must first go through police academy training. Mayor Jim Matherly told the council incentivizing lateral hires with a bonus is a faster and cheaper way to get new officers.
The cost to actually hire a brand new recruit, fresh just off the street, and send them through training, it takes about a year. Total is about a $45,000 bill, and what we're looking to do here is to cut that down by over half.
Citing a recent rash of violence in the city and the officer shortage, Mayor Matherly encouraged the council to support the bonus program.
This is public safety. Overtime alone is killing that department. We need these people quick.
The council approved a sunset clause of July 2018 for the hiring bonus program that also offers $5,000 to current FPD officers who recruit someone from another police department. The Bristol Bay Borough swells from a year-round population of about 1,000 to closer to 10,000 for the summer fishery. Almost all of the fishermen, seafood processors, and thousands of sport fishing and wildlife viewing visitors on the east side of Bristol Bay pass through one very busy small terminal in King Salmon. KDLG's Caitlin Tan was there for this report.
Within 1 hour of sitting in the King Salmon Penair Airport, one sees close to 100 people coming and going, all with either rugged backpacks, fishing poles, coolers, muck boots, or rain jackets. Kevin Richburg, Penair Customer Service Manager, says pretty much everyone is here for the salmon season.
It's never a dull moment here. You get to meet people from all walks of life here. People from different countries, people from different states. There's just so many stories. It's always something different, which keeps it fresh.
In the winter, this airport only has 2 flights per day, but during the peak of the summer, it serves up to 14 flights daily. The human traffic into Bristol Bay mirrors the sockeye run, but of course, people pile in just a few weeks earlier than the fish. Richburg says the Penair terminal in King Salmon will see 600 to 800 people pass through in a day.
It's probably a good 3-week span where everyone comes in, and then it turns right back around, probably starting the last week of July, and all the people need to go home.
The airport hires more staff in the summer to help with the influx of travelers. This year, it's 11 interns from Boston. Staff are also trained year-round just to prepare for the rush. Richburg says Penair's flights have been operating more on time these past 2 weeks, but getting all of the sport and commercial fishermen's luggage in can be a different story. Whether it shows up on time or the next flight, or the next one is part of the game of fishing Bristol Bay.
Silverbow got the bags. It's a miracle and knock knock.
That's Kayla Redenberger from Juneau, whose family fishes the Silverbow. She was pleasantly surprised to find her bags. Redenberger, like a lot of fishermen, admittedly doesn't just pack the bare necessities, evidenced by a canvas she carried under her arm.
Oh, I'm going to do a little painting on the boat. Yeah, if we have any downtime. That's the plan.
The airport is small, really just one main room to house all the incoming and outgoing passengers, plus security, employees, taxi drivers, who all seem to sit around wondering what the other people's stories are. It's not like in the winter, when coming and going at Penn Air is a common meeting point.
You see the same people at church or the same people you see at the local store. It's a very tight-knit community.
In order to keep these thousands of travelers moving, every employee on staff helps check people in, find luggage, or direct them to their next destination. Richburg says this has proven more important this year.
I think it's a lot busier than it was last summer. Herring season started. It was a lot busier this year, which got us started. And I just got the feel that there's just more people here visiting and working than there were last year.
What do you think that is?
More fish, maybe? I'm not sure. But there's definitely more people here.
It's about a week before the commercial fishing really gets going, and everyone in the bustling terminal appears to be tied to the fishery. Voodoo Kontami and Abdullah Hamad both just arrived from Africa. Hamad has worked for Trident Seafoods for 3 years, but this is Kontami's first.
Yes, I'm excited. You know, it's good. You know, we're working over here before, and now we come back. So we come from Cordova right now. And, you know, just we come over here to work and, you know, get money. And we all can see that everybody here is, you know, they're excited. So we're supposed to be excited too.
The King Salmon Penn Air Terminal, with its daily Alaska jet service, and right now more than a dozen Penn Air flights, is reaching its own peak of the season this week. The sockeye salmon run will do the same in early July. Not long after, there will be a great exodus of travelers going back the other way before things slow down to normal by mid-August. In Naknek, I'm Caitlin Tan.
As the Bristol Bay population swells with seasonal workers, organizations opposed to mining in the area are redoubling their outreach efforts. You don't have to look too far to find a No Pebble Mine sticker or a Protect Bristol Bay hoodie in Dillingham and Naknek harbors. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
Christina Andrew greets Nick Harvey as he steps into the Sustaining Bristol Bay Fisheries booth at the Dillingham Harbor. He's hoping to buy a No Pebble Mine flag for his boat.
For the flags to fly?
We do not have any more flags, but we do have letters to the EPA if you'd like to sign.
As Harvey waits on a Dillingham resident to finish signing her letter, he chats with Andrew. She tells him the latest on litigation and legislation related to the proposed mine. He's a 20-year-old deckhand from Seattle. This is his second season fishing and his first in Bristol Bay.
This fishery is probably one of the last truly wild ones in the world, and it's definitely worth protecting. It's not worth putting a mine upstream that would decimate the salmon populations. I didn't know about it until I started working up here. It definitely should be at least a Pacific Northwest issue, if not a national one, so it could use more recognition nationwide.
Andrew is the director of Sustaining Bristol Bay Fisheries. It's a new project of the United Tribes of Bristol Bay. SBBF's goal is to connect specifically with the commercial fishing industry. She set up operations in a fishing container in the harbor.
It's the big container van that has anti-pebble and fish painted all over it. When you come inside, we got a couple tables set up. One table set up with a bunch of information, a bunch of fact sheets. It has our ask to the EPA that people can sign, some stickers. Then we have all of our swag for sale in the back.
In a week and a half of being open, she estimates 500 people have signed letters to the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt. The letters express disappointment that the EPA and Pebble Limited Partnership recently reached a settlement that will allow the Pebble Project to proceed into normal permitting process. Over the weekend, SBBF hosted a happy hour at the CN Bar in downtown Dillingham. Andrews estimates 150 attended and 90 signed letters.
The importance of having the outreach in the summer, it's because this is when we have the most traffic and a lot of fishermen are coming up from out of town. So we really want to capitalize on everybody being here right before they go out fishing.
Over on the east side of the bay, Melanie Brown is tabling outside the Naknek LFS store. She's also collecting signatures to protest the Pebble Project. Brown is a part-time set netter in the Naknek district.
The more that they hear about people's concerns about the project, the more they're going to have to listen. They're not going to be able to deny that, you know, they don't have the social license to move forward, if that means anything to them.
Brown sees these petitions as a concrete way of making a difference.
You have to sign every year. If this is something that fishing is important to you and you want to continue to fish, if you have children that you want to participate in the fishery, if you have descendants that you want to participate in the fishery, you have to remain diligent. You have to do what you can to keep the pressure on decision makers.
After this week, Brown will switch from petitioning the Pebble Mine to doing what keeps her motivated, fishing. With help from KDLG's Caitlin Tan in Naknek, I'm Avery Lill in Dillingham.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Officials in Anchorage are taking the first steps to convert a blighted downtown property into an urban farm. The move is coming as an amendment to a five-year management plan for the Heritage Land Bank that's set to go before the Assembly next week. Under a proposal from Downtown Assemblymember Christopher Constant, the 15-acre site of the former Alaska Native Hospital would first be tested for contamination, then it might be turned into an urban agriculture center.
This doesn't actually do anything specific towards approval. It just sends a message to the administration that this is a desirable area to explore. The land's been sitting fallow. At this time, my personal hope is that we'll do something positive with that land. And the something positive that I think is, let's put in a farm. And I'm not talking about a garden, I mean a farm.
Constant says he'd like to see the area grow produce that can easily be brought to markets and restaurants in Anchorage, like herbs and greens. The topic came up for discussion in a committee focused on issues of homelessness. One of the eventual goals of the farm idea is creating training and employment opportunities for people living in nearby shelters or on the streets.
The ideas, let's come up with some ideas that can actually generate revenue to help people be employed. And that's part of the discussion right now is it a nonprofit or is it a for-profit? How is that going to work? I personally lean towards coming up with a for-profit that manages the farm and the nonprofit partners that are part of it.
Constant says he started conversations about the project with a number of stakeholders, including partners at the city and area nonprofits, as well as with private sector businesses like Vertical Harvest, which builds hydroponic growing systems inside shipping containers. A lot of science involves happy accidents. Late last month, a retired scientist from Oregon stepped off a ferry in Sitka and on a hunch decided to look around the woods for an old friend. And while his discovery sheds light on one of the more obscure corners of entomology, it also is a clue to how humans may have survived the Ice Age in North America. KCW's Robert Woolsey reports.
40 years ago, Lauren Russell discovered a kind of flightless flea while doing graduate research at Oregon State University. Actually, Russell can't claim full discovery rights. There was this undergrad, but what do they know?
So you're the first person to identify it as part of your thesis?
I'm the second person to actually look it in its face because I was showing the sample to an undergraduate that wandered through, and I said, hey, look at this one. I thought it was something entirely different. And he said, no, it doesn't have that. I looked at it. Oh, well, most people at that point say, eh, and go on, and I kept it.
So it's pretty great to find a new anything on the planet, but it's not like discovering penicillin or a cure for cancer. Russell knew there wouldn't be much buzz around this insect.
They're tiny little guys, are about the size of fleas. They hop like fleas, and some of them probably evolved into fleas.
Do they have a common name?
In Oregon, we call it the Oregon funny bug.
After earning his PhD, Russell became a scientist for the Environmental Protection Agency and, as many a grad student has done, left his thesis and the funny bug behind him. He believed that the funny bug only inhabited the so-called fog belt from the Middle Coast Range in Oregon to the Olympic Peninsula. But then, on a vacation to Alaska in May 2017, Russell takes a stroll through Sitka National Historical Park, where we're standing now, and easily finds a funny bug. And by doing so, Russell has just joined the ongoing academic debate over how humans migrated to North America. The funny bug contributes to the mounting evidence that along the coast during the Ice Age, there were many places that had no ice. Remember, the funny bug doesn't fly. It doesn't move around much. It's a vegetarian. Its presence in Sitka is a big question mark.
Some of these insects had to survive in place. Something with wings, something that rides on another organism, could recolonize this region. But a little forest critter without wings almost had to have a place to bite it out.
But it's not just Sitka. Carinus dectes has also been identified in Vancouver and on Prince of Wales Island. Russell lent his expertise to that survey about 5 years ago. Actually, it's not a pure lucky stroke that Russell found the funny bug in Sitka. He was acting on a solid hunch.
Why do you suppose nobody's identified it here before you?
You have to look. Entomologists don't typically have the luxury to just go out and survey. They tend to chase something for some reason. And most entomologists don't do much in the winter, which is the primary period these are active.
Russell was also planning to look in Ketchikan on his return trip home. He's contributing his samples to researchers back at OSU who are using DNA analysis, a technique undiscovered when Russell first found the funny bug, to identify what might be discrete species of the insect. What's next for Russell? Looking even farther afield for the funny bug, of course.
So I think this genus or something very similar could very easily be in the Asian side of that arc.
And reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Getting a little network of people will be able to look.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Elizabeth Harball and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Avery Lill and Caitlin Tan in Dillingham, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in training programs from office administration to water and wastewater treatment. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.